Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me, as always, is Steve. How are you doing?
Hey, John. How's it going?
You know, I'm glad we're getting along so well. Much better than Elon Musk and Sam Altman these days, fighting over this, what AI should be doing. Did you see this in the news?
About
emails and all that?
I did. I was going to say that I'm so happy that you're not going to publish my personal emails to you, begging to change the course of our company.
Yeah. You know, it seems like Elon can just go off on a little side thing very, very quickly. Or if he reads a couple of tweets, he'll go in a different direction. But OpenAI released these emails saying they should try to make money, in contrast to what he's saying now. So it's a whole little spat. I don't think it has any real impact on AI overall, though, does it?
I don't think so, no. And it's also kind of interesting that the idea is that he wanted to merge OpenAI and Tesla, have it be one company. I don't know what the outcome of that would be, but it's an interesting proposition for sure. Interesting, yeah. to say the least.
Yeah. Well, I guess it goes to show how important AI is these days, that billionaires are fighting back and forth and snipping at each other. Because he's also asking for like tens of billions of dollars from Tesla, kind of like as a ransom to develop AI further at Tesla, or else he'll do it, kind of threatening that he'll do it outside of the company.
I saw that. And also on same with the AI train as well, there's also this issue that apparently the Reddit IPO, which is going live, I think, in the next 2 weeks or so, or should have gone live by now. The whole idea is that one of the biggest sources of revenue for them in the future will be selling their user data or selling the content that they have, because they have a lot of user-generated conversations, and that's incredible for training an LLM. So even Reddit, it basically is going public as a, hey, we have a lot of training data. That's our IPO strategy.
Yeah. They got wise real quick about how everybody was using their data and how they should be monetizing.
Which makes sense. I love using Reddit. I think it's the best social-ish network. And it's definitely also, by the way, a little hack that I found is that if you want to do any sort of product
promotion
research.
Research.
Yeah. So if you want to say, find the best, whatever, laptop or whatever, just put in the laptop and then Reddit, and then you'll get an actual competition among actual humans about the actual product, as opposed to some, you know, tweaked Google thing or some paid for.
Right. Well. Yeah. I never use Reddit, actually.
It's great.
I've been missing out, I guess. Yeah. Well, you know, these are our amateur view of the world, but we have an expert in the fintech industry to give us some better insights. We have Bill Glass, the Chief Operating Officer and co-founder of OutuPay. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
So have you had time between running and growing a payments company to pay any attention to these AI spats, or does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, so I'd say, you know, this is a huge topic, especially within the banking world, not just fintech, but, you know, if we want to get a little bit more granular, you know, and we can even go a step more granular than that, you know, what you guys are talking about is Gen AI versus, you know, what we used to call back in the day is computing, right? That's traditional AI. And so, you know, having these things like new Gen AI products, like AI products like ChatGPT, et cetera, you know, it opens up a very interesting conversation, right? Like there's a lot of back and forth. I think there's policy being put into place in Washington, D.C. next week, or at least it's going to be brought up in regards to policies around Gen AI and stuff like that. So I think that I think we have a ways to come. I think AI is probably going to follow at least Gen AI for sure, is going to follow the same path of what the market, we'll call society of the market, what market viewed crypto in the beginning and how it just came out. I think it's just a lot of unexplained things happening and it's moving fast. Do I like it? Love it. I think that there's definitely a place for it. I'm still a little skeptical on the Gen AI side, but yeah.
I'm assuming that you're not using any Gen AI for your payment stuff, right? And is there a use case for Gen AI in payments?
So right now, no. So Gen AI has a problem with it, and it's called hallucinations.
Yeah.
So with hallucinations,
Steve had that same problem. Yeah.
Yeah, so I can ask it something, or I can have it study. I can have it study something today, and it'll give me a response. Whatever I'm asking for, it'll provide me that information. I can do it 2 days later, and there's a chance I get a polar opposite response. And that's the problem with us, is because you still have to be able to quantify and calculate risk. So when you're having adjustments, you know, a tool, we'll call it, give you one set of subset of answers, and then 2 days later give you another subset of answers, it's really hard for us to use it in a consistent manner. So we definitely don't use it in underwriting or anything like that. There is a use case, I believe, for it, for more data aggregation on the back end.
Yep.
And constantly giving us new updated point of views on things. You know, because it doesn't use a set of explicit rules. You know, it learns based off of patterns, algorithms, structures, and it's building upon data upon data upon data. So yeah, on the front end, we definitely can't, I don't see a use case for it right now. And honestly, not even in probably in the near future, but on the back end, definitely.
And the regulatory problem with that, if you can't explain the results and they're not consistent, I imagine the regulators aren't really happy with that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like you're always going to be chasing your tail. You know, we dabble a little bit in the high risk space. And for instance, when you have regulatory products, and you have compliance pieces to it, and something happened and you have to kind of reverse engineer the what happened situation, it's really hard for Gen AI to go backwards, where it's always going forward. So, you know, it's just really hard for us to explain the why behind things to a regulator if you can't review that, kind of rework the situation backwards type scenario.
Yeah, exactly. On the other hand, you could double your valuation by changing the name to AltruPay.ai.
I actually think we would lose valuation because the banks are so scared of anything that's AI right now.
The whole regulatory
black guy.
Yeah. You guys are in the payment space, which has had some companies with great valuations. What do you guys do different to compete with a lot of these well-funded large fintechs?
No, that's great question. So we have a philosophy of implementing technologies to mitigate institutional risk. So that could be something as basic as identifying and using tools to identify really who the person is behind submitting something to us, and just some basic tools that are going to be able to monitor a portfolio or monitor a website or do other things from that perspective that allow us to act in a more altruistic way for our customers. In our industry, we really struggle with the concept, not AltruPay, just the industry as a whole, struggles with the concept of being knee-jerk reaction. And they don't really feel the obligation to explain the why behind certain things. And I think that that's really one of the things that separates us, is we're utilizing and implementing and constantly building new technologies, whether it's embedded or it's IP, to be able to explain the why, whether it's, hey, Mr. Customer, you're growing at $1 million a year growth, I need you to slow down a little bit. Well, you got to tell a customer that, and they're going to say, well, you're probably not the right fit for me. But when you have technology to explain a risk model to someone and the reason why you're doing it, you're helping them get ahead of any problems that they don't see right now. So it really allows us to walk, talk, and act a little bit better for our customers. And it also allows us to be a lot more efficient. You know, instead of having cost out the roof of employee counts, now we're able to have productivity increase 2, 3, 4x off of one employee utilizing these efficiencies.
What kind of efficiencies?
Utilizing our technologies. So we, for instance, in the underwriting space, if you underwrite a high risk account that could take 3, 4, sometimes 5 days, utilizing technologies, whether, like I said, embedded or not, now we can do automatic data pulls. And so an underwriter can have more real-time responses, which is now cutting underwriting by a day or two in most cases.
Can you give me an example of a high-risk customer? Is it, say, somebody who sells, I don't know, guns or something? What's considered a high risk?
Yeah, so CBD is a really good example of what is high risk, right? It's a highly regulated product. It's really easy, if you don't know what you're doing, to allow a customer or a merchant to put a business online that sells real cannabis, you know, and it's not federally legal yet, versus CBD and what due diligence is you have to go through in order to distinguish between the two and obviously stay regulatory.
Yeah. So how do you, I know there's very few banks or very specialized banks that charge high fees to work with cannabis related companies. How do you guys work around this federal versus a state issue, without getting burned?
Yeah, so we don't do cannabis direct. And when I say direct, like we don't support cannabis dispensaries. We'll support CBD, but those are two different, we're going to call it industry types within kind of the cannabinoid family or the canna family. And the difference between the two, just high level, is cannabis is cannabis. It's a euphoric device that can have any type of level to provide that euphoria. Where CBD has laws behind it where it has to stay under a certain percentage of total THC, which comes into using technologies to calculate those formulas. You utilize those formulas to calculate the risk, whether it's, is it a hot product, is it not a hot product, et cetera. Going back to what you asked, or you made a statement about how there's so many banks out there that how do you juggle between the federal and the state side of stuff? Well, since the state side follows USDA law, some USDA type laws, it becomes more federally okay. So we don't have to worry so much as a per state basis as you would in pure cannabis dispensaries. But that's, I mean, to answer your question, that's kind of the split between the two within that same industry.
Any other kind of interesting customer types, high risk or otherwise?
Firearms, for the most part, is considered high risk. We actually don't consider it high risk, but I'd probably say 98% of the banks out there do. Again, we're talking about technologies. I mean, when you're able to plug straight into the ATF to verify FFL certifications, or heck, even run them manually, you're able to declassify that risk, right? You're able to bring it down because you're able to do the checks and balances that are needed to stay within regulatory things. So for firearms, it's really cool. And firearms has been a really cool industry to watch grow from a fintech perspective because it's very blue collar driven. So you typically have, traditionally, you have guys in that blue collar space that are a little bit more maybe introverted, quieter. They're not so technologically driven. But if you, I don't know if you guys have ever gone, have any of y'all ever gone and bought a gun before?
No,
I
not
haven't bought one,
me.
but I've been to a range several times, but I haven't bought a gun, no.
So the process of buying a gun in certain states, most, but is you have to be fingerprinted, you have to have a background check, you have to have all of that stuff. So to have this, we'll call it this subset class of blue collar type individuals, just watching them take what we call an A and D book, right? When a gun dealer buys a gun, it has to go on an acquisition side. So it goes on the A version of the book. And then the disposition side, which is the D side, is when they sell it. So there's a ledger that always sees every firearm, its serial number, everything at every gun dealer that's out there when that gun moves through their shop. If you were to ever buy a gun, let's say online, it would have to be shipped to an FFL dealer so they can accept it and dispose of it properly on their A and D book. We're now seeing guys at rapid rate shift from having that traditional paper, pen and paper piece to having more of a digital A and D book, something that's stored in the cloud, something that the ATF can come and audit 5 years from now. And not to mention the level of biometrics that are being introduced into the federal firearm space, the fingerprinting systems that are being done now that, you can walk into even a mom and pop gun shop that maybe has a shop out of the back of his house. These guys would typically be a cash register if even that. Well, now they have actual fingerprinting machines there now that put it straight onto your form that you have to sign when purchasing a gun. So it's really cool to just see a market, fintech in its, I'm going to call it its purest state, grow even at a and with an industry that maybe would give it the most pushback. So it's really cool to just see that firearm space really grow from a technology standpoint.
Is this a space that the larger players, the more traditional, say, in the more traditional incumbents are going after, or is this a space that's more ripe for players sort of like AlterPay and companies like you to go after?
Yeah, so I mean, yes and no. So yes, in the sense of there are some bigger players in this space. No, in the sense of there's not a lot of them. So we are able to be competitive. We're a smaller company, we're more nimble. So we can walk, talk, and act a little bit cleaner than what's, and when I say cleaner, just walk, talk, and act how our customers need us to, as opposed to being in a big conglomerate, call it like First Data or NAB or Paysafe or one of those.
Sure.
These are ginormous companies that provide payment services, but you're kind of a number to them, right? So we can get more granular into niche markets that carry higher risk because we can still calculate that risk a little bit better while supporting them the way that we need them to.
You're based in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. How is the fintech or technology scene out there in terms of like hiring or raising money, that kind of thing? We always hear in the news about Austin as sucking right up all this tech talent and capital. How is it growing a company in Dallas?
I'm going to say it's pretty parallel to Austin. I mean, I think they dubbed Austin the new Silicon Valley.
There's always a new Silicon Valley, yeah.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, it's great. You got Elon coming to Austin completely. Everything's moved there. So, you know, at the end of the day, you've got just natural interest moving to Austin, whether I'd say you have a job or not. So I think the labor force in Austin is phenomenal. Getting people to move to Dallas is actually becoming a lot easier.
How far is that about?
3 hours.
3 hours driving. Okay. Little commute.
Yeah, it's not bad. but I think Dallas just got voted also about 6 months ago as the private equity hub for the United States. It took it away from New York City. So, you know, you're seeing private equity, venture capital money, stuff come in to really fund these technologies with the banks and, you know, everything on the West Coast when you have these signature banks and everything else that are failing because they're so hedged into the tech space. I think that is what makes the Dallas market and the Austin market a little bit more advantageous because the banks have not been flooded with all that venture capital. So it's specific to one technology realm. So, I mean, the banks are a little bit stronger and they're hedged, which I think in return gives them the ability to be a little bit more flexible, maybe lend a little bit more. But ultimately, the labor market for sure is a pretty strong market.
And I'm curious whether the presence of talent and business sort of equates to also the presence of money. Is it easier to fundraise if you are actually fundraising within Texas, or do you have to actually leave the state and go elsewhere?
I think that's going to be a very industry specific answer. I think that in our space, I think it's pretty easy to fundraise almost anywhere. When you move money and you get paid to take points off of it, people typically like to invest in that. And especially when it's a residual driven approach. So
when you're as talented as Bill, Steve, people are going to throw money at you. Come on.
Exactly. You can go anywhere.
So, you know, it's there. When I said industry specific, you know, when you drill down into like, what is that company's pure focus? You know, what is their go-to-market? Are they driving revenue? That's a whole nother topic we could probably talk about, right? Like you have these brilliant individuals that are standing up technologies for brilliant use cases, but they really struggle with maybe phasing the project out to realize, hey, we got to start getting revenue in somewhere. I think that's a big battle. But in our space, I mean, the technology and revenue kind of go hand in hand. So it makes it very attractive for, call it a, you know, some capital to be introduced, however it is going to be introduced to a payments company. But when you get those industry, drill down into those industry guys, you know, that's where it starts to become difficult no matter where you're at, right? It's to fundraise for, let's call it a widget that is going to, I don't know, calculate my tendencies to speed or not speed on the road, you know, and I'm making something up here. That's going to be a very finite subset of an investor versus a very general payments company that you just have to discuss risk at that point. Right. So that I think that it's kind of hard to answer that question, but for us, definitely we can fundraise anywhere. And you, as long as you got a good go-to-market strategy in our space and you're executing it, it's pretty easy to fundraise.
And you guys have been growing quite a bit. I guess you've been around like a little over 6 years and you've actually expanded internationally. Is that right?
Yeah. So we're really big. A space we have not talked about with you guys for high risk is our gaming division. We do a ton of gaming operators and gaming manufacturers and distributors within all realms of gaming, from daily fantasy sports to sportsbook betting to sweepstakes lottery, and even now the big hit is these big iGaming teams, e-gaming teams, having a payment source to be able to sell their merchandise. You know, with social media, it's taken things to a whole new level. But over in the UK, there's a lot of gaming opportunities over there as well.
Oh, so that's your foot in the door to get into Canada and Europe and Latin America as well, right?
Yeah, so LATAM is kind of its own beast, but setting that aside, you know, we look at regions kind of the same as the rest of the financial world, right? So Europe is EMEA, and that's kind of its own little region. Australia is its own region. LATAM is its own region. Then you have North America, which is traditionally split. Mexico splits away from the U.S. and Canada. And then you have kind of that Caribbean and Mexican market. LATAM rolls up a little bit. But outside that, I mean, you really, it's distinguished kind of that away. So our primary focus right now is U.S., Canada, and EMEA region, which is Europe, U.K. primarily. We try to stay away with everything going on with the war. We just try to stay away from that Eastern European.
Yeah, I would think so.
It makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you have to have a separate compliance group for each region? Does that kind of build the overhead a bit?
No, so we really rely on our bank partners to drive that compliance tool and that piece. I think that that is one of the things that our banks love about us. And, you know, I was with one of our bank partners last night, and during dinner, you know, when we were going through some compliance stuff, that was his response is, you know, as long as you can stay nimble and agile with what our requests are, then, you know, we can almost push the limits anywhere as long as it's calculated, legal and lawful, et cetera. So that's one of the things that we really focus on is building partnerships with our bank channels where we will let them run their compliance through us. And our whole goal is kind of going back to what we started this conversation with, right? Technologies, utilizing technologies to mitigate institutional risk. So I'm going to use that statement to answer your question is, if we build stuff and we can explain it to the banks and it makes sense to them, we don't have to carry the compliance overhead because now they understand for face value what we're doing and how we're approaching market. And giving them demos with all these technologies and doing this stuff and helping them understand that gives us the flexibility of not having to have an entire massive compliance team.
So you build the engine and then they take care of the front end and all that kind of stuff, which is a good place to be, I would think. Well, we mentioned Gen AI a little bit at the beginning. Any other technologies that you'd like to build up or that are exciting to you or that would help your efficiencies quite a bit?
Yeah, I think we live in a right now society, you know, and that's really kind of a struggle when you're in the banking realm, the financial services realm. And when you're looking at companies like a Square or a Stripe or a Shopify or we were talking yesterday about Lightspeed. You know, when you're looking at all these other companies that really separated themselves from everybody else in the payment space or even in that financial technology space are really the ones that created an early approach to embedded finance and using the embedded finance concept. And you can look at it from multiple avenues, right? We've got Stripe, for instance, or I believe it's Stripe. It might be Square, but for Stripe, for instance, they have all the financial data at their fingertips, right? And they can aggregate it and calculate it in ways that may give the ability to,
sell it.
Well, not sell it, but issue that, pre-approve that customer for a $20,000 loan.
Okay, got it, yeah.
So and now
better,
you're
better
adding,
information, yeah.
Correct. And now you are creating ancillary revenue streams while at the same time that customer gets to live in that right now concept. If I'm a restaurateur and I know that I could use a new walk-in fridge and I get a notification from, call it Stripe, that, hey, I qualify for a $25,000 business loan. Well, if I can afford it, why would I not just click accept it and order my fridge like that? And now I didn't have to call a finance company. I didn't have to call a lender. I didn't have to fill out applications. I didn't have to talk through underwriting. I didn't have to do anything, but it's all built on embedded finance. So that is really kind of our focus in 24 and 25 is to really create a more, we're going to call it a clean approach with just a slew of products that are going to tie into one portal to just really help that customer, that merchant excel to the next stage. The other thing that we're working on is a program on the issuing side to where we'll be able to issue digital cards and and stuff. So whether it's, you know, a wallet formation and they need physical cards or digital cards for any reason, we can issue those to end use consumers. And then who knows, that might roll into its own issuing platform, but baby steps for now. And the whole goal is the customer experience for 2024.
Yeah. Plenty of new opportunities, which is what every entrepreneur always sees ahead, not challenges, ways to grow. Is there anything that was stopping you from growing more, that if I could grant you a wish, what would you wish for that would help you grow faster or get to the next stage?
Probably clone 6 of me and 2 of my partners.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Just making the deals and yeah, planning and everything.
Being in multiple cities at once. That'd be nice.
You're just bouncing around, working with clients and growing new markets then all the time. Is that correct? The life of the payments entrepreneur?
Yep. Sounds about right. We've got different avenues for obtaining new clients. So, you know, we've got a few, what we call referral partners. So it's always important to stay in front of them and keep the good ones happy and try to keep, you know, the ones that maybe not submit a whole lot of deals to us, maybe try to figure out what we can do to help them grow. Yeah. And then, you know, bank partners. I spend a lot of time in front of our banks and our bank partners, and I'm in Las Vegas right now talking to you guys from Park MGM because we're at a big compliance and risk conference. So, you know, it's just constantly staying in front of the moving target, and, you know, we try to touch as many of our clients as we can while we're in those areas as well.
Yeah. So when you sit down with these bank partners, what's kind of the question that you always have to answer, or concerns that they bring up?
It's more me taking concerns to them and working through some stuff. We tend to try to forget that all the banks don't have all the technologies or all the agile abilities that we have. So sometimes we have to remind ourselves to take a step back when we want to move, call it 100 miles an hour, and they're moving at 50. But, you know, trends change. And on the bank side, their regulatory pieces and compliance pieces are a little bit different than ours. So it's, you know, you're taking two people with a single goal, but we have to stay compliant almost the same, but a little bit different. And banks have to take in other considerations to stay, you know, balanced, their risk profile to stay balanced. They have to take deposits, lending, paper sales, all that stuff into consideration. So, you know, if they have a bad month somehow, some way in a different sector, maybe it's a bunch of bad mortgage paper or something like that, the total bank's portfolio could flip-flop. And therefore, the bank may be a little knee-jerk and say, hey, we're going to scale back from this industry type. And it's my job to go and make them comfortable with it, and let's keep moving forward, and let's not, and stuff like that. So it's, you know, it's a chess game. You got to love on them.
Yeah. So any banks or fintechs that you kind of admire what they're doing right now, creative, innovative, or just good business?
Yeah. I mean, I think more of it's vendetta driven, right? Because I'm jealous, but, yeah, I mean, sure. I'm gonna give
that's
the
a
shout
sign
out
that they're doing something interesting. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, they're doing something good at least, right? I'm gonna give a little shout out to Shopify. Shopify really took a market, and especially after, you know, during COVID and post COVID, just have really excelled at it and really created that easy to use, easy to understand, easy to grow platform. You know, so kudos to those guys. And then we've got a lot of up and comers. I've got a buddy of mine, Sebastian Duels with Arkham, is using some AI and machine learning tools and some really cool technologies to help from a retention perspective with people. And so there's some really cool fintechs that are coming out right now that have gone to market and really excelled. And I think we'll be definitely talking about them as a household name probably in 3 to 5 years. Shopify is obviously already one, but they're good. In the payment space, I'd really probably say Stripe. Stripe from a e-commerce integration perspective, but I'd probably say Square probably hit it on the nail of just doing something from an economies of scale perspective for the small business owner. So, you know, you've
Yeah,
You talk
both
about.
of those have really changed the way we think about payments in those
Yeah.
cases.
Yeah. For good and bad, right? I mean, Square, for instance, started out by just giving away, I think in the very beginning, they gave away their plugins, right? To the phone. And that's just how they did it. And then they said, okay, well, we can scale this. And they went to Walmart. And now you can go to Square, buy a Toggle, and open a Square account in your car. Now, I say for the good and bad because, you know, for a landscaper or for a beautician or something like that, like that's perfect. But when you're getting into the firearms guys, when you're getting into the higher risk stuff, or even just regulatory items, Square's problem is it's ran as a PayFac model. So they approve all the accounts up front. And the merchants are never educated on what they can and can't do, right? We see this all the time in gaming. We see it all the time in firearms. And Square has the legal ability to hold funds for up to 6 months. So if you're a merchant, a small business owner, and you know, like you said, a household name that they've really changed the way we look at things, what do? They go and they open a Square account because it's easy, right? Well, in 2 weeks after they've ran $50,000, Square's going to
They're
hold them.
like, oh, you mean I can't do that?
No,
Yeah,
yeah.
right.
Yeah, now they're holding, now Square's holding all their money. So,
They're
you
not really
know,
set up for that, right? They're just
they're
set up for
not.
the mass retail kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I mean by Stripe did a really good job from the e-commerce integration piece because they do allow the small business owner or the enterprise level account to use their system as long as it's an approved industry on their platform. Again, gaming, firearms, those type of businesses are not able to go into Stripe. But yeah, I think they did a better approach than Square from an e-commerce perspective. But Square really nailed it. So that's why I kind of said vendetta, jealousy.
So yeah, keep up the good work then, and helping these customers, these high risk areas, and growing into different countries. We wish you all the best. Keep up the good work.
I appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah, thank you. That's Bill Glass, the Chief Operating Officer and co-founder of AltruPay. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening.